online. I'll start over again. We do have a quorum now, so I'll call a meeting to order of the House Transportation Committee. Today's Thursday, the 1st of February, and it's about 1:07 p.m. And we have Kapsner and Wilson, Ogan, myself, the Chair Corney. And what we'd like to do is just a minor change, if it's acceptable to the sponsors of two bills here, to first hear the DWI bill, and then we'll get into House Bill 79, if that's acceptable to Pete. I know I just mentioned to you a few minutes ago we'd do it the other way, but one of our members here does have to leave fairly early for a doctor's appointment, so if it's all right, we'd like to hear the DWI bill first, and then we'll get into House Bill 79. Also on the calendar, if time permits, is House Bill 55. I think we'll have time to get to that bill. That's, of course, the oral response legislation. We do have at least one individual on teleconference. We'll get to him. That's in regard to House Bill 39, looks to me like. And anybody that wishes to testify here locally here will certainly provide that opportunity, too. So with that, I'd like to call Representative Cott forward, who's a sponsor of House Bill 39 and just the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the illustrious Transportation Committee. Representative Pete Cott, representing District 24, which consists of Eagle River, South Fork, and Muldoon. What you have before you is a bill that addresses what I believe is part of the problem that we've experienced in Anchorage related to the increasing number of DWIs over the past 2 years, but especially this past summer. As a consequence to a great number of incidents, Mayor Wirch created a task force to address the issue. I had one of my staff members participate in that forum over the course of the summer. As a consequence to the meetings, the public input around the state, primarily in the Anchorage area, the mayor's task force came up with several recommendations. And we reviewed the recommendations and opted to include several of those recommendations in a piece of legislation, which is the version that you have before you, House Bill 39. Since that period of time, we have evaluated things, especially the fiscal ramifications of the bill, and have then revisited some of the issues. Those issues that are remaining are now contained in the CS, which members have been provided. So unless I can go into the CS and tell you what was removed from the original bill, if that would be the will of the committee, or you can adopt it and I can tell you what's in it. It's your pleasure.
My recommendation would be that we just simply adopt the new CS, since that's what the sponsor would like to advance, so if there's a motion to adopt, we would do so. Okay. Is there any objection to adopting the CS? Hearing none, we have the CS before us. Thank you.
Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, members, then I will briefly take you through the sections of the CS that I think are appropriate and which will have a substantial impact on reducing the original size of the fiscal notes that were accompanying the previous bill. Let me just point out, before I do that, there's probably good justification to indicate why the bill was pared down to the level that it currently is. And there was three areas in the previous bill that was problematic. And I'm not saying I don't want to underestimate the problem out there, but I certainly want to indicate that it was going to be a costly endeavor to accomplish the objectives in the original bill. And the first problem that we had was dealing with the registration requirements. We were requiring that the Division of Motor Vehicles be able to have access to the criminal records. And at the time, I was under the impression that that access was available. However, since discussing many of the issues dealing with that with the department, I've recognized that it is not available. It would have to be a newly created piece of software that would then intertwine both of the databases. That was one of the problems. The other problem with that, of course, is that we have third-party vendors in this state that we have authorized to register vehicles. And it was just, we'd be just turning back the clock. We're trying to go to a more of a privatized system of doing business, and there would absolutely be no way that we could require the private sector to develop or become part of that software package and access both the vehicle records as well as the criminal records. So in light of that, that was a huge problem. We removed that from the bill. The second part of the bill that we removed was the piece dealing with confiscation of vehicles. Again, after talking to the department, we recognized that this would be overly burdensome, extremely expensive. You could not implement it on a statewide basis because of logistics, rural versus the urban areas. And even in the urban areas, there'd be some inequities. For instance, if you were driving a $25,000 Cadillac and had it confiscated, it'd be a little bit different than if someone were driving a $200 junker and had that confiscated. So, I mean, even as it would be applied in the urban areas, and they're experiencing this in the Anchorage area right now, you would find there would be some inequities. The third area that we removed was the look-back provision. Essentially, right now, in state statute, if you get a third DWI within a five-year period, it's a felony. We opted to remove that, so in essence, we would restructure the sentencing part of the DWI law, which would then suggest that if you got a third felony, whether it was 5 years from now or 25 years from now, it would be a felony. And after getting the numbers from the department, we recognized that we would need probably another 800 beds immediately. I mean, there'd be another 800 prosecutions if that provision were kept in. So, Mr. Chairman, what we did was we took those three areas out of the bill, and that's what is now left in CS that you have before you. And I think while it's perhaps not entirely where we want to go, and I think there'll be some additional inclusions as we move this through the process and marry it up with other pieces of the legislation, what is left in the bill is, number one, it does require valid proof of insurance before registering a vehicle, which right now I think many of you recognize. All you do is you say, yes, I've got proof of insurance, but this would be a little more proactive. You have to provide either your insurance card or a copy of your insurance policy before you could have your vehicle registered, and I think that will take care of a little bit of the problem out there. I mean, it's one thing to get involved as a victim in a DWI accident and suffer the pain and consequences, but then on top of that, to find out that the person that hit you didn't have insurance, and now it's real problematic. So you've got a problem that's extremely compounded, if that were in fact the case. So this may be able to take at least part of that and resolve at least that portion of the issue to some extent. I mean, obviously, someone could get insurance one day and get their vehicle registered, and the next day just turn around and have it removed or call the insurance company. No longer want to be insured, but at least that I think is a little bit positive in the sense that we're heading in that direction.
Excuse me for interrupting, Representative Cott. Ogun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cott, so if I understand it correctly, to gel that down into 10 words or less, it requires proof of insurance when you register the vehicle in hand.
That's correct.
Considered requiring people to carry proof of insurance on demand of an officer?
Well, I believe right now in state law, you're supposed to carry your insurance card in your car. I believe that's the case, and DMV could, if someone's here from the department, they might be able to correct me, but I believe right now you have to carry that insurance card with you.
Maybe we can have some testimony from public safety on that point, but I think it might not be a bad idea to have the committee consider requiring get pulled over by a policeman, ask for your license, registration, proof of insurance. Those three things. Because there's a whole bunch of people out there driving around without insurance. And, tremendous exposure to other people. And it would just thought maybe the committee could consider that and see whether or not it's in law now. I don't think it is.
Yeah, I agree. Certainly, that's a real problem out there, but I again, I think, at least in Anchorage, talking to some of the police officers that I know personally, if someone is stopped for a traffic violation and issued a ticket, summons, oftentimes they put a notation on the ticket that you also have to provide proof of insurance when you pay your ticket or, you know, something to that effect, so that they are, in fact, insured, and they know that once the ticket's paid. I mean, often, you know, a lot of times the insurance card is a small card, unless you're carrying it in your wallet, and that's probably not a good idea. It's misplaced, and you know, you're already gone through this, you know, hectic time where you're fumbling through your wallet looking for your driver's license. Now I get to get my registration, and certainly your insurance card should be attached to your registration, but some people, you know, they misplace it and put it somewhere else. But
Mr. Chairman, on the registration, we sign a sworn statement under penalty of perjury, if I'm not mistaken, that we have insurance and we'll maintain insurance the whole time the vehicle is registered. Of course, you know, it's hard, you know, vehicle sitting there, you let your registration go, or, you know, you don't drive it on the road, they're not going to catch you, but basically you're signing a sworn statement, if I'm not mistaken, if memory serves me, so.
I believe that's correct. You are signing that under at least someone under oath, and you're supposed to have that insurance while the vehicle is registered. But we know, based on the, I think the about 20% that's been suggested that don't have insurance. Many of those folks, I'm sure, either didn't have it, or they signed that statement falsely, or it was they requested their insurance be dropped, or it was dropped for other reasons. So they're driving around without that insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cott, what about renewals of insurances, or of if you want to renew your vehicle online, how would this affect, you know, trying to show proof of insurance if you were to renew your registration online?
Having not done that myself, I don't know if it's even available. I think it might be, but I mean, there's probably going to be a statement on there that, again, you're doing the same thing. Of course, at some point, I'm not sure how that program works. If it's like the dividend where you receive something, you can do it online, but you receive something in the mail and you got to sign it and send it back at some point. I'm sure that covers that particular point, and it may be that the department, when they generate regulations that implement this section, they may require you to fax in or to photocopy a copy of your insurance policy or the card when you send that in. Obviously, if you're signing something, you got to sign it. I mean, that automatic signature is, we're not quite there yet. I would defer that to the department on how they would handle it. I would suspect if registration is available, you would receive something in the mail, and they would probably request you to submit a photocopy of your insurance cover page or your insurance card.
And do you have a new CS that would reflect this work draft that we have in front of us?
Now, the working draft is the CS, and you know, I don't want to get into the details of how the department should do it, and it would leave it to their discretion to implement it. And I don't think we want to get so detailed to specifically say this is how you're going to do it. I'm not sure what the best way would be. So I've given the department some latitude, and of course that would be reflected in any regulations that would be published for public comment.
I want to note that we are working off of a committee substitute here that was adopted after three members showed up, who I wish to acknowledge at this point, Massive, Kukesh, and Scalzi. So for your benefit, we do have a CS for House Bill 39 before us, which is a much scaled-down version of the original legislation with the intent of trying to get the fiscal note, frankly, zero, I guess, and perhaps you can address that when you get it.
Well, yes, and Mr. Chairman, if you want me to continue through, unless there's additional questions on the first section.
Yes, we can do that, then we'll get into the fiscal.
I mean, if there's questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them at this point.
Thank you. Representative Kukesh, and then Scalzi.
Good question. I'm sure that it's in the statute someplace, but is there a definition for a vehicle already that we're going to use? That's already
there. There's a definition.
I know there is. I figured that's what you're your act would relate to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question, the new scaled-down version, it has all this on Section 3, C, D, E, F, all taken out of it. Is that out of the original language that's been removed?
Yes, that's been removed. So it's now we're back to status quo as it currently exists in state statute.
Okay.
To make sure I understand what we've got here before, it's just simply the issue of the liability. That's the primary thrust of the legislation, then?
That's the primary focus, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. That you'll notice that Section 2 says that treatment is required under the subsection, which is the section dealing with the third offense and felony provision, shall occur as much as possible within the confines of the incarcerated location. There is, again, latitude there as much as possible. It should be done, I'm leaving it again up to the individual locations as to whether or not those services are available in those communities. So there is, again, some discretion in what has to be done and how much it has to be done. And finally, Mr. Chairman, in Section 3, that's the section that basically pulls this unit together, something similar to the Merrill's Task Force, and they're responsible for periodically looking over the DWI statutes and trying to come up with a better mousetrap. Basically, that is what is left in the CS.
And I know part of the goal is to get the cost down to virtual zero. Could you address the, well, first of all, we do not have a fiscal note before us, but if you could explain the why we end up with a zero fiscal note, which is good.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, you know, when I looked at the original bill and compared the fiscal notes, I essentially removed the sections that had the significant financial impact on the state of Alaska. And based on what is left, I don't believe, in my estimation, that there are any costs associated. And if there is, it would be so minimal, I believe that the fiscal note could be zero. And I'd defer again to the department as they comment on the new version as to whether or not there would be any fiscal impact. I would be surprised to see much.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. We're going back up under Section 2. The treatment required under this subsection shall occur as much as possible while the person is incarcerated. Who's going to pay for that treatment then? How does that work? Is the person that is incarcerated going to have to pay for it? Or how does that? So I'm just trying to figure out how it's not going to cost any money.
Well, it wouldn't cost any, Representative Wilson, to the chair, members of the committee, wouldn't cost anything more than what's currently being done. I believe the state is picking up the costs of not only the incarceration, but that treatment as well. And it may be just the application and prescription of a new drug that I believe is, the cost of that is $99. You can get it as low as $99 for a month's supply that has the tendency to make the person not want to get near alcohol while not having the same side effects. That seems to be the direction that some of the states have taken who have wellness courts.
Any further questions?
What the definition is of a motor vehicle, whether it's registered motor vehicle, like if somebody is driving a four-wheeler or a snow machine while intoxicated, and in here you have aircraft and watercraft. And I can't think of a time on the Kuskokwim or the Yukon when somebody's been in a skiff and had a DWI for driving a watercraft, or under the influence of driving a watercraft.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that driving a skiff under the influence, you could be subjected to a DWI conviction. I believe the only area that I'm familiar with that is perhaps not contained in the vehicle language dealing with watercraft are those
jet
skis. I don't believe they are included in state statute. In fact, it's one of the areas that we're looking at changing on another area, another issue. Not that. I believe that's the only
jet ski guys drink and drive.
Oh, they're terrible.
Messick?
Under Section 3, says you added in the public. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, and in essence, why the public was included in that was that as we experienced the opportunity to participate in this task force that was created by the mayor of Anchorage, the majority of the membership were public members, and they came from a variety of circles, from the beverage industry, from MAD, and just individuals out there that had an interest in trying to curb some of the drinking while driving. So we thought it was imperative that we keep this candle lit, if you will. They have made a pretty sizable impression, I believe, in the Anchorage area. And I thought it was important to keep that group going and not blow out the flame.
Since it was the city or the municipality of Anchorage, do you think it's possible that if this was not included, that you know the municipalities or the boroughs could form their own organizations and putting a task force together to work with the agencies of the state, or you think it's really necessary to include this in the bill?
Well, I think you have to have it in there, only sense that right now any borough or any community, any municipality has the opportunity to create a task force, if you will. Department of Public Safety, transportation, those folks could get together. And all this does is it says, okay, if you're going to do that, we also need to include members of the public. And I think that's only appropriate since the public are the ones that are out there crying out for some kind of solution to the problem. And if they're crying out for solutions, then I think they ought to be part of the solution. And their input, I think, is essential. That's how we test the waters, I guess.
What I'd like to do at this point, unless there's further questions, is to note that we do have some people online via teleconference. But before we take any testimony, I wanted to let those know, assuming that you can hear me and Matsu and Fairbanks, that we do have this committee substitute. So the bill that you were going to testify on might be a lot different than what you expected. We've got a watered-down version here. And if you've been with us since the onset of the meeting, you probably got a good description as to what we have before us. Having said that, does anybody either in the Matsu or Fairbanks still wish to testify on the bill as presented? Now let's start with Matsu. We have John Kent. John, are you there? Don't hear John Kent. If you happen to come back to the meeting, you're certainly welcome to offer your thoughts on the bill. We'll move to Fairbanks. Christine Rowinski. Christine, are you there? Okay, would you? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but we have you down as yes, as having wished to testify.
I'll say that I'm very, very disappointed that we haven't got a better bill. And we need to support what's left of this bill, but I think that we can be done, and improvement in a lot of other places. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next person in Fairbanks is Al Neer. Are you there, Al?
Yeah, I'm here, and first I'm here to speak to several of the parts of the bill that are no longer in existence. I was feeling very positive about H-39 when I read it over, and especially after looking at the report from this task force group in Anchorage, I felt there was a great promise here for doing something to actually have a positive effect on reducing the fatalities on our highways by drunk driving. And I think someone looked at the paper and noticed what happens in cases of drunk driving can come to the same conclusion as I have, that almost all of the highway fatalities are caused by repeat offenses. And what we have to do is find a way of controlling this situation. And one of the ways that has always appeared to me to be viable was to take away their weapon. And now in HB 39, we have that promise. We might be able to do that, but it doesn't look as if that's going to be the case. It appears that all we have left now is some possibility of guaranteed insurance when someone registers their car. But so far, I haven't found a policy yet that will actually bring people back to life. So that what we're doing here is really serving the purposes that were set forth by the task force committee at all. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We'll move on to, unless there's any questions for the testifier, we'll move on to, I think this is locally here in Juneau here. It doesn't say on my sheet here. Is there a dean, Department of Law, Dean, are you here? Do you wish to address it? Thank you. I see you've got yes check marked here, so sorry for not automatically recalling your name, Dean. I know you've testified before us numerous times in years past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guinelli, Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As Representative Cott indicated, there's a lot of interest about drunk driving and the tragedy that creates on our highways. There have been a lot of bills introduced. Representative Cott has a couple of them. Others have other bills. What we in the administration have been trying to do is take a coordinated approach to the problem of drinking and driving. In doing that, we've been working closely with the Speaker and the Judiciary Chairman to try to put together, if not in one bill, at least in a series of bills in a package, something that would comprehensively address the problem. And I just want to describe briefly what our approach is, and then I'll speak very quickly to Representative Cott's bill. But the approach that we're trying to take involves a number of components. One, there's going to be a prevention component that we would propose, and that would include fixing the problem of minor consuming. The Alaska Supreme Court really put a stop to the use it lose it program, where minors would lose their license if they drink, and we think that there needs to be changes in the minor consuming law. There needs to be, we believe, some changes to the bootlegging laws to make it easier to address bootlegging in rural Alaska. We think that's an important part of a preventive effort. Another aspect of a coordinated approach would be intervention in drunk driving. And that would include, for example, 0.08. There's the 0.08% blood alcohol as the triggering level for a drunk driving prosecution. We're going to be forced into doing it by the feds or else lose a lot of money. I think the testimony in the House Judiciary Committee was that right now there's about $850,000 a year in federal incentives available if we went to 0.08. And in a couple, 3 years, there's going to be a lot more than that in the way of penalties that we will suffer if we don't go to 0.08 blood alcohol. And so I think that's certainly an important factor. Another aspect of intervention is to look at the way we treat third offenders. Right now, we only look back 5 years to determine whether they've had three drunk driving convictions. There have been a lot of proposals to change that look back period to extend that. And so that, you know, that's something that needs to be looked at in a coordinated approach. We're also very concerned about treatment, and certainly there's a provision for treatment in Representative Cott's bill. We believe that what's required is really a formal assessment of the needs of any drunk driving offenders, clinically appropriate treatment based on that assessment of needs, and perhaps even treatment in lieu of going to jail to reduce the fiscal impact on the Department of Corrections. We need some technical fixes, for example, to make it easier for everyone to get access to past treatment records to really be able to assess what the treatment needs are. Another aspect of treatment is wellness courts or therapeutic courts, something the Speaker is very interested in and has asked us to help draft a bill in that regard. So, again, my message is we're trying to take a coordinated approach to look at all of the bills globally for prevention purposes, for intervention purposes, for treatment purposes. There is going to be, although we're trying to do it in a way that the cost to Department of Corrections won't be increased greatly, there's likely to be some cost, and certainly if we want to really improve treatment, there's going to be some cost for health and social services, and so another aspect of a coordinated approach is going to be increasing revenues, and I hate to use the T word, but that may mean a significant increase in the alcohol taxes. So that's the approach that we are taking. The Speaker has asked us to work with the Judiciary Chairman to try to deal with those issues there. I think although There are a number of items that were in Representative Costa's original bill that are no longer there in the committee substitute. All of those items, I believe all of those items that were removed, are in somebody else's bill. And so I think all of it will be discussed at the appropriate time. With respect to Representative Cott's bill, I hope that Mary Marshburn from the Division of Motor Vehicles is on the line from Anchorage to answer any questions about the insurance and registration aspects. I think Division of Motor Vehicles may have some concerns about logistically how to carry that out, and I'd certainly defer to her to answer any specific questions. Candy Brower from Department of Corrections is here to answer any specific questions about the part dealing with Department of Corrections. I think Department of Corrections feels that it has very limited funds available for treatment in its facilities, that to really do an adequate job of treating alcohol offenders, it would need much more in the way of treatment. And there's really a question as to what is the appropriate time to get treatment. For many drunk driving sentences, it's 3 days is kind of the standard for a first and 20 days for a second. And it's really questionable whether you can get effective treatment in that length of time. And so it's left to doing something afterwards as a condition of probation. For longer sentences, it may very well be appropriate to at least begin treatment in the facility and maybe follow it up afterwards. But
try it there again.
But I think that there needs to be coordination by the Department of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services, in looking at the entire area of treatment of these offenders. And finally, the last portion about coordinating with the public and collecting statistics. I'll certainly let public safety and other departments speak on that, but I really have no further comment about that. I just wanted to give you a sense of kind of the big picture. I'm certain that all of you are aware of it to one extent or another, but I wanted to let you know the administration is actively working with the speaker and the judiciary chairman. And so we're very hopeful that there'll be meaningful progress this session.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bonelli. Are there any questions for Ms. Fire?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Quinelli, on the I know we don't have we have a CS before us, but with a leave with the chairman, I'd like to maybe discuss something in the old version.
Sure.
If that's all right. The forfeiture, did that require under the old version, was that after the first offense? Is that the way I read it correctly?
I believe it was after the second.
Second, okay. All right, just
okay, thank you.
That's all. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your testimony. I do appreciate it. I'd like to go back to the mass suit and see if John Kent has come back to join us. Are you there, John? John Kent and the mass suit LAO. Okay, we'll move on to the next testifier. It looks to me like the others that have signed in here are just a listen only, don't wish to testify. We have folks from Anchorage as well as here in Juneau. Perhaps at this time we can have Ms. Representative Oden.
If somebody's here to answer questions, I'd like to maybe ask
Mashburn,
possibly public safety about the insurance issue.
I was going to
Mr. Chairman?
I was going to get to that momentarily. Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Whatever you wish.
This is Mary Marshburn at DMV. We
yes.
Are online. Can
okay.
Answer questions when you're ready.
Well, Mary, I was going to get to you actually right at about this point. I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, Scott, we can have Mary answer some questions, then we'll have a public safety join us, if that's acceptable.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman,
Mary?
For the record, my name is Mary Marshburn. I'm the director for the Division of Motor Vehicles. I'd like to thank Representative Cotton and staff for faxing me a copy of the CS. We got it about 30 minutes ago, so we have had the opportunity to look it over. Couple of points. I'm not sure which member of the committee asked if a license has been revoked for a DWI on a watercraft, and the answer to that is yes, we have on more than one occasion. Someone else on the committee asked if watercraft, if the definition of a motor vehicle included a watercraft, and it does not. A watercraft is, definition is separate. If that answers those two questions. In terms of insurance, if you'll look, I'm assuming this committee has a copy of the
note that we submitted on House Bill 39.
Yes, we do have it before us. At least I do. Do members have a copy of that, the original fiscal note? If not, we can reproduce what I have here.
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bottom of the first page in the analysis,
the original fiscal note,
analysis box, second sentence.
We're circulating it now for members of the committee.
House Bill 39, which contains the same language regarding the insurance requirement as the CS. We say in the analysis of the fiscal note, the insurance requirement would have no fiscal impact because the current program of self-certification could continue. When we read 39, our interpretation was that this would allow us to continue the self-certification provision. That goes back to Section 2810.021A2 of the statute, which require us to include the self-certification and to have a checkbox for people to complete. That in turn allows us to do the web and the IVR and the other forms of sort of faster, more convenient registration venue. If we misunderstood, I apologize if we misunderstood this provision to Representative Cott, we have not had a chance to discuss it with him. Requiring something other than self-certification, the furnishing of paper, if you will, whether that is an insurance card or a copy of an insurance policy, will impact the division, and it will require a fiscal note. We will have to re-examine that and would need to submit a fiscal note on it. One additional comment I would add, or a couple of additional comments on this topic. One, registration of vehicles is for 2 years. An insurance policy normally runs only 6 months to a year, so the two don't match. Second, an insurance policy, or proof of insurance, if you will, is only good for as long as the individual does not cancel the insurance. I can call my insurance company today, I can order insurance, I can cancel it 3 days from now or a month from now. And the fact that I have a card or that they sent me a card is not really truly proof of that insurance. What other states, and there are a few states in which this is a requirement, have found is that there is an additional paperwork burden. It affects some of the more convenient, faster registration venues. But it really doesn't go a great distance towards assuring the carriage of mandatory insurance. There are two most reliable ways to assure that people carry insurance, and this comes from the International Institute of Insurance Associations. The first one is a third-party electronic verification, which is an expensive program. The second most effective way is self-certification, and this is Alaska's program. The national rate for uninsured, national average of uninsured motorists is 14% in the state, and Alaska's rate calculated, we just calculated it for 2000 as part of our performance measures, is also 14%. Very briefly, those are my comments. As I said, Representative Cott and I have not had a chance to discuss this, and if we misunderstood the provisions of that section in the original bill, we do apologize.
Thank you.
And if we can answer any other questions the committee might have, be happy to do so.
Thank you, Mayor. Are there questions for Mary? I just wanted to reiterate for the benefit of the committee that the fiscal note we have before us is, of course, a reflective of the original legislation, which is substantially changed. So our expectation is that the new fiscal note, which we haven't received yet, possibly might be zero or a small positive amount, and we'll certainly know we have that issued by the various impacted agencies. Yes, Representative Massey.
I had a question for the DMV on the CS that we have in front of us. I asked it to Representative Cott, and I was just curious about renewals that are done online in regard to proof of insurance. How would that work?
Representative Mathick, Mr. Chairman, it would require that some form, as I heard described, some form of paperwork be sent in when you renewed your vehicle online. Once again, registration is for 2 years, but insurance coverage is generally only for 6 months at a time, 1 year at the most. So we'd have to deal with that problem. Second, on the DMV end of things, it would require human intervention to marry that up with the online or the telephone registration. Right now, that's a completely automated process from start to finish. You call in, and there's no human intervention, barring the unforeseen, between your call and when you receive your registration in the mail. So we would have to have some human intervention to marry the documents up and double check them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Further questions? Okay. My recommendation at this point would be to hold the bill over until Tuesday, and perhaps if we have the fiscal notes up by then, we could address it and move the bill out of committee. And of course, we would also respectfully request Representative Wilson, a sectional analysis, since we do have a new piece of legislation before us. So we'll just ask the agencies involved to work with Representative Cutt producing those fiscal notes and the analysis, and then we'll take this up for consideration again on Tuesday and hopefully move it at that time if it's the will of the committee. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, and I really don't know the answer to this, but I would like to know what percent, when you force someone to go into treatment, force someone to take the treatment, I know of several people that were forced to go into treatment, and normally it does not work unless they have a mindset that they're ready to go to treatment. And so I'm wondering, does anybody know what the percent of success is on someone that's forced to go to treatment versus someone that goes willingly? Does anybody know is there anywhere that there's percentages so that we know? Because that does take money to have that done somewhere along the line. And I'm just wondering what the percentage rate of success is.
I don't know myself, but if there's somebody here who's an expert in that area that has knowledge of what the answer might be, you're welcome to address us, ma'am.
Yes, my name is Pam Watts. I'm the director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Through the chair, I believe that, although I don't recall the exact percentage rate, that virtually the entire treatment field would support the understanding that the recovery rate is almost the same for people who are forced into treatment as people who go voluntarily, because almost nobody goes voluntarily. Most people go under duress, either through the legal system, through their families, or through some other external environmental reason that they enter treatment. So for the most part, granted, a lot of people say, well, if you don't want to go into treatment, that you can't really recover. But the point is that most people don't want to enter treatment. At some point, they do have to make a decision to pursue recovery, but it's not necessary at the time that they enter treatment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I wish to apologize to a member in the audience here who came to testify. I didn't recognize the fact that she had indicated she wishes to, and so that would be a Cindy Cash. And Cindy, would you care to join us and offer your thoughts? And I'm sorry for not immediately recognizing you, because I know we met in my office just yesterday.
All right.
I know we all meet so many people, and it's hard to keep track of everybody.
Thank you. My name's Cindy Cashin, and I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, otherwise known as MAD. And for the record, I went in to rehab against my will, and it's working for me, and it's been almost 5 years. So it does work even when you don't want it to. I have some photos I wish to show you. I have these photos before you to show how drunk driving can kill anyone, and how this could be anyone's car or anyone's truck or anyone's water bottle or anyone's blood. These photos were taken at a scene, at a drunk driving crash scene on April 19th on the Kenai Highway. It took the life of my father, Lad McCauley, the life of his boss, Martin Richards, and severely injured Steve McGee, who was sitting next to Martin. This is my dad. And this is Martin.
Excuse me for interrupting, Sandy. I very much apologize. Those of you that are on the line via teleconference, could you please talk away from the microphone because you're interrupting the meeting, just to point that out to you. Thank you. I'm sorry, Sandy. Go ahead.
That's all right. What I'm trying to show is that these pictures look like anyone's car or anyone's truck, anyone's water bottle or anyone's blood. It can happen to anyone. I thought because I was sober, maybe my family was saved. Maybe it wouldn't happen to us. I never really thought it out loud, but in my mind, subconsciously, I did. Because that was one of my first reactions when I found out that my father was killed by a drunk driver. I want to thank you for letting me have this opportunity to speak about House Bill 39. I sincerely appreciate the time you are taking to listen to someone who inform you that some days are harder than others. Some hours are more difficult than others, and unfortunately, today is one of them. A victim does not get to pick when he or she feels the pain of loss at its greatest. I hope you will have patience with me if at times I have difficulty speaking. The bill I'm going to talk about is the original bill. I was caught unprepared for the amended bill. But I feel that what I have to say on behalf of MAD and on behalf of victims throughout Alaska is important enough for me to continue saying this as it's informative and it's educational. So I apologize if I bore you, and I hope that I can help you. MAD supports House Bill 39 because MAD advocates compensating or impounding vehicles or plates from the vehicles of habitually impaired drivers or those who drive while under driver license suspension or revocation, where the suspension or revocation was the result of driving under the influence or any other alcohol-related driving offense. Yesterday I brought over to your aides more than 50 pages of studies and statistics from MAD, which I hope will help you. There are two studies regarding vehicle impoundment, one from California and one in New York. When the vehicle impoundment law was passed in California, DWI fatalities were reduced between 1995 and 1996 by 44%. In 1995, there were 1,484 deaths due to drunk driving, and in 1996, that had gone down to 837. In El Monte, California, in 1997, the fatality injury collisions were reduced by 35%. Both first-time and repeat offenders whose vehicles were impounded had fewer crashes. There was a 25% reduction for first-time offenders and a 38% reduction for repeat offenders in California once this law was passed. I've also included a study by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration about the impact the impoundment law had on motorists caught driving without a valid license. In California, people are almost four times more likely to be in a fatal crash if they're driving around without a license or a valid license than those who do have one. First-time offenders, when this law went into effect, first-time offenders had a 25% reduction and repeat offenders a 38% reduction. Obviously, this law has had a serious impact on not only first-time offenders but the chronic drunk drivers, the high-risk drivers who traditionally have been resistant to change, and those are the drivers we have a major problem with in Alaska. In 1999, in New York, there was a 14.3% decrease in total drunk driving arrests when this law came into effect. The DWI-related accidents between February 22nd to April 12th, 1998, and then February 22nd to April 12th, 1999, a six-week study, showed over a 29% decrease immediately. The law went into effect February 21st, so they did a quick six-week study, and already it went down 29%. 29% fewer people were injured because this law was put into effect. Now, this statute has been upheld by both the New York State Court of Appeals and the federal appellate courts. Appellate, thank you, appellate. In 1998, as part of the TEA-21 Restoration Act, a new federal program was established to encourage states to address the problem of the repeat intoxicated driver. To comply with Section 164, the state's law must require that certain sanctions must be imposed on persons convicted more than once within a five-year period of driving while intoxicated or driving under the influence of alcohol, DWI or DUI. One of the sanctions that must be imposed is that all motor vehicle of repeat intoxicated drivers be impounded or immobilized for some period of time during the driver's license suspension period, or that an ignition interlock system be installed on all motor vehicles of such drivers for some period of time after the end of the suspension period. States that do not meet the Section 164 requirements will have a portion of their federal highway construction funds redirected into other state safety activities beginning in the fiscal year 2001, this year. In addition, TEA 21 modified the Section 410 grant program. Under the program, as modified by TEA 21, states that qualify for a basic grant may also qualify for supplemental grant funds by meeting one or more of the six criteria. One of the six criteria is a program to reduce driving with a suspended driver's license. In order to qualify for a supplemental grant under this criteria, a state must impose one of the following sanctions on individuals convicted of driving after their license has been suspended for an alcohol-related offense: suspension of the offender's vehicle registration and return of license plates, impoundment, immobilization, forfeiture or compensation of the offender's motor vehicles, or use of distinctive plates on the offender's motor vehicle. As far as the cost to make this bill possible, MAD is strongly endorsing an alcohol excise tax. As well, Fairbanks currently operates an impoundment program with great success, with an automatic administrative fee to cover the necessary paper and administrative work that is required. Anchorage does this as well. I mentioned Fairbanks in particular because we're looking at Juneau doing this. The municipalities are not eager to do this unless there is a law that the legislators pass making them do it. They won't do it unless you tell them to do it. MAD feels this bill, the original bill, would be part of the answer to Alaska's drunk driving problem. While MAD realizes this is only part of the puzzle, we need all of the pieces in place before we can begin to accomplish the job of preventing drunk driving. Would this bill have saved my dad and Martin's life? I'll never know. Will it save other lives? Yes. Is this a bill which works for the good of the people? Yes. Will it prevent unnecessary deaths and injuries? Yes. Do I or does MAD want anyone else to suffer as I am suffering? No. MAD encourages you, and I ask you to please pass this life-saving bill. And once again, I'm talking about the original bill, not this other piece. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Cindy, thank you so much. Representative Wilson.
Will you go back and read the part where it talked about one of the things was impounding, one of them was immobilization. Would you read the list
Sure.
of the different things that's on there?
There were six. They have to do one of six. States have to do one of six. Suspension of the offender's vehicle registration and return of license plates, impoundment, immobilization, forfeiture or compensation of the offender's motor vehicle, or the use of distinctive plates on the offender's motor vehicle.
Representative Logan?
Mr. Chairman, the kind of the use of distinctive plates, kind of like a scarlet letter for the adulteress back in the, that's kind of a public shame thing, and plus identification for police officers, is kind of the idea behind that?
What they have found in states that have used those plates, the chronic drunk drivers are, it decreases. They're less apt to get in the car and drive when they've got a red tag on it or a zebra plate. Also, the people, if the person still chooses to drink and drive and they have that plate, those also on the road with them are more apt to watch them. And if they're drunk driving, they'll notice it and call it in. MAD does not go after the driver, we go after the choice. And there are many fine people who have chosen to drink and drive, and I'm one of them. If I were to be convicted of drunk driving and I had to have that license plate, would that change my drinking and driving habits? I don't know, but I think I would seriously think about it.
Yes. It seems to me might be an intriguing idea that there's certainly a lot of ways around it. You know, register the car and your spouse's name, your kid's name, borrow your neighbor's car or your brother's car or something. I know if I was, of course, people are driving and drinking aren't using maybe the intelligence that they do have, but if I was drinking and driving and or had a problem with it, I think I'd probably, you know, I knew I was going to go out and party, I would probably definitely not take that car, you know, figure out another way. But, of course, they're not making good choices anyway, so maybe we're dumb enough to do it. It seems to me it wouldn't be that big of a deterrent.
When the chronic drunk driver goes out to drink, he doesn't really think that he's going to, first off, kill anyone. And he doesn't go out thinking that he's going to drive home drunk. He thinks he's just going to have one or two and then go home. And it's really not the plan. I'm going to go out and get totally wasted and then try to drive.
Thank you very much. Say, I want to note that I actually knew Mr. Richard. I was on the Alaska Housing Board that interviewed him for a CEO position many years ago, so I had a chance to get to know him. It was certainly a shock when I learned that he had passed away in that accident last spring, so I've been touched by this myself. But thank you so much for your testimony, and we certainly will be mindful of your recommendations and ask that you work with various sponsors of the pieces of DWI legislation that are before us.
Thank you.
And try to get as many of your ideas incorporated as possible.
Thank you.
Representative Gott, would you care to join us again? Or were you leaving? Or
I'm trying to get away, but I guess.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought you were signing up to join us again. My suggestion at this
Mr.
point.
Mr. Chairman, I can just make a couple of comments based on some observations. First of all, I want to make it perfectly clear to this committee that the committee substitute that was introduced, that you adopted, should not be taken as indicative of me being soft on DWI. And that's clearly not the case. And you have the prerogative in this committee, if you want to pass out the original version, by all means. If that's what you would like to do, I'm certainly amenable to that. My only thought was, when I looked at the fiscal note, I asked myself, $40 million for this piece of the puzzle, is this the best use of state dollars? There may be some other areas that we can address in the DWI entanglement that could better utilize the money. So that's my point for the introduction to CES. Is this the best use of state dollars? It may be that this committee feels that it is, then I'm more than willing to ride the horse to the trough.
Representative Logan?
Mr. Chairman, I came into the committee, I studied the bill and did a little research on it before I came in, and I came in with some concerns that, boy, this is pretty tough, you know. And I had a few concerns with some due process things and stuff like that. However, it went from being too tough to, I think, too soft, and no reflection on you. I understand where you're at, but I wonder if there's a way that the committee could explore some of these ideas. You know, MAD's got a publication out. Maybe look for ways that the perpetrator of the crime can bear the cost of impoundment and bear these costs, you know, rather than the state, and make it some real, you know, I mean, if they have to, some serious fines, you know, your vehicle's going to be impounded, you know, so the court costs, you know, make some stiff enough fines associated with these impoundments and these kind of things where the people that do this pay for it. Really? And reduce the fiscal note and get after these problem drunk drivers that we're trying to get off the road that are killing people and these repeat folks that just don't seem to get it. I don't know, it's early in the session, I don't know if you'd want to appoint a subcommittee to maybe explore some of that. I mean, I know subcommittees are, or if, you know, the sponsor wants to work on so that to expedite it, because I certainly don't want to hold the legislation up and study it to death and that kind of thing. But with a few exceptions, I think committees should do as much of the work as they possibly can in the committee. I mean, unless there's like a total agreement on something that's going to happen next time, but just food for thought.
Would you be amenable to a subcommittee to explore some of these possibilities, or would you prefer to just keep the legislation?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm certainly amenable to whatever the committee would like to do. I just would caution you that if we explore this issue too long, I think the objective will be missed. The objective is to get something on the books this year, and this is just a small piece of it. And whether you go with the original version or the scaled-down version, at some point, all of these pieces of legislation that are directed toward resolving or at least mitigating as much as possible the DWI problems in this state are going to be married up. At some point, that's going to happen, I can assure you. There'll be some pretty tough laws out there. The cost of it, I can't tell you what it's going to be. It could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on what approach we, as a legislature, decide to take, whether or not we want to approach the problem from the front end or the back end, and whether or not this treatment, i.e. the wellness court that seems to be working in other states, are in fact included in the legislation. But you know, I have no qualms. If you want to study it, that's fine. Explore some other ideas, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I just don't want to miss the opportunity at some point where we get everything together and we can sit down toward the final stages and make a determination on what we want to see included and what is the best use of the available funds that we have at our disposal.
This may not be an all-encompassing bill that we would ultimately like to see passed. However, it's I think a good start, and it's got good provisions in here that would behoove us to put into law, I think. And perhaps what we could do is, upon receipt of the fiscal note and the sectional analysis, I'll move the bill on Tuesday, and thereafter we could still have a subcommittee to explore legislation that the committee itself could advance.
That'd be real fine, Mr. Chairman. And one other point I would just like to make, and we are in week four, or almost week five of the legislative session, and the other objective that I had was to get the discussion moving ahead. It seemed to me that many of these pieces of legislation were just sitting idle, and I think some of the testimony we heard today is noteworthy, and it's important to get this out early. And I think once we do that, then we can start in a direction. But right now, there wasn't anything happening. So,
Representative Wilson, and then Olga.
I think the original bill. I think anybody would be absolutely crazy not to realize that we do have a problem and that we need to do something. I think we probably all know people. I mean, I know people personally that don't have a driver's license because of DWIs, and it's just something that really needs to be dealt with. And I'm sure if it happened to one of my family they were no longer here because of someone that had been drinking, I would have thought the $40 million would have been well worth it. You know, so it's really a shame when we're looking at something, and I'm sure we probably almost all agree it, and then we look at the money and think, where is it going to come from? I really don't know the answer either, but I think that we really need to be very serious. And is there another, what's the next committee this goes to?
Judiciary.
Judiciary?
Judiciary, yes.
Maybe maybe it would be wise to go ahead with a recommendation that we really feel that it needs more work yet or something.
Yeah, Representative Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I could support passing the bill out as CS as it is, because I don't think it does enough.
It doesn't really.
And I would hope that we could, as a committee, maybe just come in, look at this stuff, maybe come in next time or whenever is appropriate time if you don't have something else on the schedule, and have just a work session, you know, take the public testimony out of it, let's sit down and brainstorm and see what we can come out with, get some experts in to see what measures of the original bill that we can impose without such a big fiscal note and pass the costs on to the perpetrators of the crime or whatever, and just kind of have a brainstorming work session and try to get it out in an expeditious manner. But I personally don't think I could vote to pass it out, because I don't think it goes far enough.
Well, we'll hold the bill over then until Tuesday. In the meantime, if the sponsor could maybe arrange to have folks to address us on those particular concerns. And I really like the issue of putting some real teeth into this thing as far as putting the onus on those that commit the crimes, the perpetrators, and have them fund this as much as realistically possible, as opposed to the state through the general fund. I mean, that would serve a twofold purpose. That'll keep our fiscal note low as far as what comes out of the general fund, and it might also, you know, provide the incentive we need to let these people know that we get behind the wheel and drunk in the state, that that's wrong. And if you're going to do that and commit a crime in the course of your intoxication, you're going to pay a severe penalty. So with that, I'd like to just hold this over until Tuesday. And since we do have a another bill by the...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be back before you. And I would just add that if you give me $500 million, I can resolve the DWI problem.
And I want to thank you for your patience and your willingness to hear this bill second to the DWI, because we had a member that had to leave early for a doctor's appointment. So appreciate your indulgence. So the next bill before us is the House Bill 79. That's the co-naming the Eagle River Loop Road to the Veterans Memorial Road. So take your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, members of the committee, this one is certainly not as convoluted and complex, and it should be very straightforward. This bill is doing nothing more than naming a portion of the Eagle River Loop Road. Those that are familiar with Eagle River and the Glen Highway, it starts at the overpass, actually at the Anchorage landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the newer roads in Eagle River, of course, was the extension of that Eagle River Loop Road, the Riggs Bridge. And this particular area would then end at the corner of the intersection of Eagle River Loop Road and Eagle River Road, which there's a Walmart. That might be the landmark where you can get an idea. A portion of that highway is designated at 55 miles an hour. So I think in honor of the men and women who have served the country, and we're always looking at taking care of our veterans as best we can with the limited resources that we have available, this is just one little show of gratitude for those who have fought and died and protected our freedoms. And it's at no cost. And of course, I think you all know that the state of Alaska has a great number of veterans in the state. We're now second per capita, I think, behind Wyoming. I don't know how they got ahead of us, but somehow they've been counting a little squirrely there. But we certainly have a great number of veterans in the state. When you take consideration, active duty, the reserve, our National Guard, and certainly in the Eagle River Chugiak area, we have that high concentrated number as well. I think it's probably a little higher in that area than perhaps around the rest of the state, although I couldn't tell you that for sure. But all this does is just provide a name to that portion of the Eagle River Loop Road.
Was that correct, Representative Cott, that we're talking about a co-naming as opposed to a renaming road then?
Right, so we're not renaming
the Loop Road.
Yeah, the folks that are living on Eagle River Loop Road, which I don't believe there are any, but if there were, they wouldn't have to change their post office address. They wouldn't have to print new business cards. It's
zero fiscal note. Probably all we're going to just see is one of the small blue signs on the road.
See probably a little blue sign.
I see Dennis from the DOT, Dennis Bouchard, nodding his head yes. So that's
his testimony.
And it's in the packet. Fiscal note's in the packet. I've been. And unless you have further thoughts, I'd like to just briefly have Dennis address the committee just to assure us that.
You're real fine, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the city's consideration of this one. If you pass my .08 bill, if there's any fiscal note, that $700,000 plus that the state would get, and we could take just $10,000 and make the sign happen.
All right. Thank you, Pete. Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dennis Bouchard. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner in Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This is the second naming bill we've had up before the committee this year. I've been doing this for 4 years now, testifying on naming bills, and I even testified on one of yours last year, I believe, Mr. Chairman, and for consistency's sake and so that you don't think I'm playing favoritism to Representative Cott, I'll say the same thing to the committee that I said on your bill, and that is that every year for the last 7 years, with the exception of last year, our maintenance budget has been cut, and every year we have additional burdens, albeit very small burdens, placed upon the department in terms of the amount of maintenance responsibility that we have, and so I'd just like to point that out to the committee, but that being said, we support the legislature's right and ability to name things, and we think this is a worthy cause, and we support this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Bouchard. Questions are provoked.
Maybe if you quit picking up all those political signs, you can paint a few more signs on these, but anyway, yeah. So is this kind of a recent trend where, you know, in the past it, legislature name a lot of roads after people, or is this my imagination, or are we just doing this more and more?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ogun, you know, I've been doing this for 4 years, and we've had at least three bills every year that I've been here. If you look at the statutes, Title 35, Section 40, there's several things that have been named, from bridges to various roads and portions of highways. So I don't know that it's new. It's been around for a long time. I'd say there might be a small increase in the number of them that are being done each year, but I wouldn't say it's a substantial increase.
Are there any roads left?
Through the chairman, I'm sure if you had something you'd like to name, Representative Ogun, we could come up with something for you.
Thanks so much. Any further questions? I wanted to note that I really appreciate the sponsor advancing this. I think it's a very fitting memorial. It's too bad we couldn't have heard this bill yesterday when the VSW folks were in town. That would have been good timing. But without any further questions, what would the committee be?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 79 in committee with the attached fiscal note with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
Any objection to moving the bill with unanimous consent with the attached fiscal notes? Hearing none. Fiscal notes, excuse me. Hearing none. The bill is adopted. Thank you very much, Mr. Sponsor. You bet. Okay, we'll move on to the next piece of legislation. That's the carryover of House Bill 55 that we've heard already two or three times in committee. I'd like to note that we've got some folks here that wish to testify on the bill, or at least to sign in. Let me interpret this. We just handed it to me. We have Larry Dietrich of DEC. That's there you are, Larry. I saw you come in. That's available for questions. I'll call you up momentarily, and then also Paul Hughes. Thank you, Paul, for joining us. I wanted to note for the committee that there's a letter that we've obtained from the department. Let's see, where I'm going to just call a brief ad each here. I got to find my letter here. The issue of the industry being governed through the regulatory process and perhaps unnecessary regulation, that's addressed in the legislation here. The issue of employees, that was another one that we had wondered about. Is it prudent to fund legislation of this nature that would result in more people being hired? And I think Larry Dietrich has sufficiently addressed that issue in paragraph 3. And the other issue, what was the third issue, Mike? The issue was the fiscal note, the issue. We were wondering about the what impact this program would have on the 470 fund. We had talked about that before. The 470 fund is monies that are generated into a special oil cleanup fund that is from the North Slope oil. We get 3 cents per barrel out of that, and with the oil revenues, or the amount of oil going through the pipeline declining, that has a direct impact on this program. And we were concerned that perhaps there may not be enough money to fund the various programs that are currently relying on those monies if we were in fact to pass this legislation, which would take $250 million, you know, out of that particular fund. And I'm not real comfortable with the information that we've got so far, that it's not satisfying my quest for information as to whether it's going to in a detrimental way impact that fund and hurt some of these other programs that are relying on it. So having said that, what I'd like to do is have Larry come back to us at this point, Larry Dietrich, and maybe go over the contents of this letter here and maybe address the fund issue as well and my continued concerns there. So, Larry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the Director of Division of Spill Prevention and Response.
Thank you.
Would you like just to highlight the letter, then?
Yes, please, if you would.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we attempted to try to address some of the concerns raised at the prior meetings, and appreciate the deliberation and the consideration you all have given it. With regard to the one issue about the long-term sustainability, we did check with the Department of Revenue projections for crude oil production down the pipeline. I believe that was included in your packet at one of the prior meetings. If not, we'll make those available again. They have projections for crude oil flow out through 2010, which is as far as they carry their projections right now. The department accepts their projections. They're the official source for the state on the flow through the pipe, and are the ones that make the projections and on the revenue that provides to the state for this purpose and for many other purposes. So we don't alter, adjust, or try to change any of those projections at all. We accept them at face value. And when you look at the out years for this against the long-term cost of this fiscal note for implementing this legislation at $141,500 a year, which is what our current estimate is, this is about roughly a little over 1% of the revenue generated by the 3-cent surcharge. And that provides the basis for us to conclude that this would be sustainable under a long-term forecast, at least as far out as they're reaching with the forecast right now, which is 2010. And that is the cost that would be in place after we go through the startup of the program in FY03 and FY04, and then are into the steady state mode, as shown in the fiscal note. So that was our rationale on it, Mr. Chairman.
The issue of employees, can you address that in your third paragraph there on page one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the employees, we understand the concern about the growth in state government, et cetera. We have ratcheted back the note substantially since the first estimates were made when the task force originally completed its work. And the assumptions we're making now is that the private sector approach that's envisioned by the task force here will come online. And what we've done is we've modified our assumptions to take into account that the spill cooperatives, the incident management services, the marine exchange, the ship's agents will all indeed provide the services that were, I think, envisioned by the task force as being the way to get this legislation implemented. And so as a result, we cut back the fiscal note, and we converted two of the positions to temporary positions as another contingency, such that it's another way of providing a checkpoint so that if after FY3 and FY4, those positions won't linger on, so to speak. I mean, we change them to temporary to accommodate the peak workflow period during the phase-in of the program, and are leaving them as temporary so that they indeed will go away at that point. And then we also recommended that we take stock at the end of that fiscal year, FY04, and then make adjustments as may be appropriate based on the actual workload that comes in.
Thank you very much. I think that is commendable to the fact that you originally ended up with eight recommended employees, and you've got it whittled down to two, and I really appreciate that. What I'd like to do now is get into the issue of the regulation of the industry here. We were concerned that this might be opening the door for excessive of oversight and control of the maritime industry, and we had the issue brought to our attention by Ogun and his recommendations, and those have been, in fact, put in the form of amendments that you should have before. If not, we'll provide you some copies. We'll do that now. So, Scott, I'd like to have you go ahead and address your amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment, I move, I guess we call it amendment number one. And
any objections to moving amendment number one?
Well,
I'm ready.
The amendment number one would essentially put the legislative intent into law and codify it into law, and say that the task force recommendation on the motorized oil transport and the documents used in the preparing report shall be used as the guidelines for drafting regulations to implement this legislation. I think that has a little more force of law than simply a letter of intent attached. It gives the industry the ability, if they feel that there's regulations that exceed what the task force intended, what the legislature intended, and go into court and at least make the case before a judge that this was not the legislative's intent, and gives me a little bit more comfort with the bill. And I think I have been told, although I'll let them speak for themselves, that industry representatives, and I'm not sure, I'll let the department speak for themselves, but that there seems to be broad support for the amendment.
I certainly would echo Representative Ogun's thoughts in regard to the intent of the amendment here. I was concerned that the legislation may not be carried out as far as what the intent of the legislature is. Not that we don't trust the agency, it's just there might be a difference of opinion as far as to what extent do we care the regulatory process. So I think the amendment is proof.
Mr. Chairman, I think I might characterize it a little bit differently, or at least to add on to what I said was the industry wants some rope to hang themselves. I'd like to give them as little rope as possible. So they're asking for rope, we'll give them rope, but no more than they need.
Thank you. Mr. Dietrich, I understand that you, and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't have a problem with this particular amendment. Is that true? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We would concur with the amendment. We did participate in the task force, we believe, on an equal footing basis with the other members, and we agreed to that as a consensus package, and we feel obligated that the task force report is our instruction book for writing the regulations. So I think the amendment is a good one, and I think we can support that.
Further questions? Representative Wilson, is your hand up for a question?
I'm just not quite. You're on the page one, line 10?
Yeah, just deleting section one, essentially. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, just so essentially deleting this section.
So we're skipping this part up here?
Just have to get the bill out.
You're deleting this and putting this in.
Okay.
Yeah.
He didn't say that. Are we deleting section one and putting the other part in?
Renumbering.
No, that's just renumbering it. Delete section one and insert section two. It's a technical change.
Yeah, yeah.
It's creating a new section one, Mr. Chairman. On line three of this amendment, creates a new section one. In line 12 of the amendment, deletes, it's just conforming the rest of the bill. It just says delete the word section one and insert the word section two, so it doesn't change any sections. It just makes it conform technically, as do the rest of the rest of the language in the amendment. It's conforming.
That's being adopted. That's the amendment that we're adopting.
I believe I erred previously as far as the parliamentary procedure here. I asked for an adoption of the amendment at that time, and that was premature because we need to discuss that amendment and make sure the committee had a full understanding comfort level. So I'd like to actually withdraw that adopting the amendment and proceed at this point. And so is there an...
You corrected yourself and said just move the amendment for discussion. Okay. So you were okay.
Will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
Okay. Is there any objection to
and ask unanimous consent.
Any objection to amendment number one? Hearing none, the amendment is passed, and we have the amended version of House Bill 55 before us. I'm not asking for a motion to move the bill at this point, though, and just for the committee's information as well as the members here, I still have a concern in regard to the 470 fund issue and what the projections are, and I'm not trying to slow the bill down necessarily. It's just something that I think we need to make sure we have adequately addressed before we move the bill out of committee, and I'd like to hear it at least one more time on Tuesday so that we can, in the meantime, gain the information that we're seeking in terms of getting our questions answered. I understand that you folks at DEC are working with Senate Finance on this issue right now. That's what I've been told anyway, on what the projections of this 470 fund are, because our concern, at least mine, is that if we tap into this so substantially, it's going to take away monies that are funding important programs like the underground storage tank remediation. There's folks in the MATSU, actually, that have used monies from that program to help finance the replacement of a leaking underground storage tank. So those types of programs and those types of peoples could potentially be negatively impacted if we were to substantially delete this fund. So we wanted to learn as to what can we reasonably expect the future to hold in terms of available dollars and how this is going to impact that fund. So I'm waiting for that work to conclude, and then we'll, at that point in time, proceed with advancing this bill forward and possibly moving it out of committee. And my hope and expectation is we do move that bill, and I'm not trying to slow anything down. I just want to make sure that we are at a sufficient comfort level as far as the fiscal concerns here. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just regarding the fiscal side of it, the 3% surcharge, and I may direct my question, 3% surcharge that you spoke of, is that a new fee that's being added?
I believe, excuse me for nothing, it's a 3 cents per barrel surcharge as opposed to a percentage. But Larry, please.
Through the chair, Representative Scalzi, the 3% surcharge is 3 cents per barrel on Alaska crude oil production. It was originally instituted as a nickel a barrel following the Exxon Valdez, and then it was changed and split from a nickel to the 2 cent and a 3 cent account in 1995.
I didn't phrase my question right. The way you said it originally, when you said 1% of the 3%, I was kind of, I just wanted to be clear if there was an added revenue that was coming out of this year. But it doesn't sound like. We're just talking about the standard surcharge on a barrel of oil. And your estimate was that 1% of that would cover this cost, I think is what you said. Is that correct?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Scalzi, to clarify my remarks, the 3 cent surcharge is the price per barrel that flows through, and it currently at current production rates, which is the Department of Revenue forecasts, they forecast the volume through the pipe. It generates approximately between $9 to $10 million a year is what it generates, and so the $141,000 for the fiscal note for this program. As a percentage of that amount generated, the $9.4 million is a little over a percent of that revenue that's generated from that 3 cent surcharge.
Thank you.
All of because I had heard you make that statement too, and my first impression was, and I hope people on television don't get the same impression I did, that we were going to take 1% of the 3% that was out there, not 1% of the total amount that's generated. $141,000 is only 1% of the $9+ million that's generated.
That's correct.
If you take 1% of the 3%, then you're talking about $3 million.
That's correct.
So we just wanted to clarify that, and I'm glad you brought it up.
I apologize if I was confusing on that, Chairman. Yeah, it is 1% of the total revenue generated.
I just wanted to note that we do have various folks online. If any committee members have any further questions for, say, Brian Rogers, who addressed us in the past. Thanks for joining us, Brian. And also, of course, I'd mentioned Paul Hughes is present here, too. But it doesn't appear that we have any more questions at this point. I'll ask one final time. Are there any more questions or comments from the committee? Just in closing here, I'd like to hold it over until Tuesday and to say that we are making good progress, and I appreciate those involved with this. Thank you very much for your letter, Larry. We had asked for that last week just to address in writing the concerns that we had, and I see that we're making substantial progress, and that's really encouraging. So we'll hear this bill again on...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. I apologize for missing you, Charlotte. Charlotte, why don't you go ahead?
Many options proposed, including fleet plans, response